In weather news today, a little market dysfunction across parts of Texas continuing till it warms up a bit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 16th of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We begin today, we begin with a little bit of weather, actually, and then some market peculiarities that are being laid bare because of that weather. The weather in question, of course, is in Texas. Deadly and dangerous cold and snow and ice. Something like 3.5 million people are still out of power, which gets us to the peculiarities of the Texas energy market. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on it.
Power grids need energy makers and energy users to be exactly in balance, says consultant Cheryl Roberto at Synapse Energy Economics.
Essentially, electricity is a just-in-time product. It needs to be made the moment that we need it and delivered to where we need it.
There's barely any energy storage in the system. In Texas, power suppliers can't keep up with desperate demand for heating. Natural gas wells that produce fuel for power plants are freezing up, and plants themselves are going down, says Joshua Rhodes at the University of Texas Energy Institute.
Power plants that don't have their water intake lines winterized enough, sometimes those freeze.
To prepare for emergencies, some parts of the country pay plants to build extra capacity. That's costly, and policymakers chose not to.
Texas made a conscious decision that we wanted to have an efficient market so that it would produce the lowest prices for customers.
Not today. Texans are so desperate that electricity, normally selling for $35 a unit, is going for $900, says energy economist Ed Herz at the University of Houston.
These folks are paying hundreds of dollars to keep their homes and apartments warm on a daily basis right now.
He says power companies are making a killing today because that's the way the system works. When producers make less product, it's so scarce, the price skyrockets. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So there's not enough electricity, and what power there is crazy expensive. You're freezing cold inside. The kids aren't doing any Zoom school, and maybe your boss probably still wants you in a meeting or something. So how you doing? Marketplace's Samantha Fields has been making some calls.
At Savita Namajuri's house, just north of Dallas, the power has been coming and going since yesterday morning.
Hey, Samantha.
Hello, I lost you.
Yeah, we lost power as we were speaking.
That is making it hard to do her job at a marketing agency.
Losing power, that took the Wi-Fi away. The cell phones weren't working, so it wasn't even like I could use apps on my phone to stay in touch with my team.
But Namajuri says she feels lucky that her family at least has power some of the time, so their house is staying pretty warm. For millions of people, that is not the case.
It's 45 degrees at our house right now, and we still don't have any power.
Emily Hilton lives in Houston with her husband and two kids. Their power has also been out since early Monday, and it finally got cold enough that she decided to take a friend up on her offer to come over and get warm.
We've been so cautious with COVID, like extremely cautious.
But she says with no sign of when the power might come back.
I was just like, look, we need our 10-month-old warm. Like, I don't know what to say.
In Austin, Arlo Gilbert also took his wife and kids to his mother-in-law's, but then came back home to keep an eye on things.
Myself, and I know I've talked to all my neighbors, we're all really, really worried about pipes bursting.
But when he and his dog woke up this morning,
we could see our breath indoors, and it became clear that there was no way I could ride that out any further.
So he left his faucets dripping and drove up to his mother-in-law's. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but crude oil closed above $60 a barrel today for the first time in more than a year. That is West Texas Intermediate, by the way, the U.S. benchmark. In equities, it was much warmer in lower Manhattan today than in parts of Texas. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is back with its new season about work and jobs, how they've been changing, and how they are going to be different in the aftertimes. Today, a story that's kind of on the economic policy news right now is the Biden administration and congressional Democrats try to figure out how hard to push for raising the minimum wage. Yes, it's the law, $7.25 an hour right now, but as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, the host of The Uncertain Hour, tells us, not everybody gets it.
This is my mop bucket. This is still the original broom.
It's been more than 10 years since Jerry Vasquez worked as a janitor through a company called JanPro, but he still has his old equipment, his uniform, and he still remembers one of his first nights on the job, cleaning a big daycare in Southern California. It had about 100 kids, many in diapers or potty training. When it was time to clean the bathrooms,
there's like a bomb of poop all over the place, pee all over the place.
When Jerry got his first check, he discovered something. For all the hard work he was doing, he was making
maybe $5 an hour.
$5 an hour, way below the minimum wage guaranteed to employees in California at the time. But according to JanPro, Jerry was not an employee. He was the owner of his own janitorial franchise business, an independent contractor. And independence was exactly what Jerry had wanted when he first got involved with JanPro. He was helping care for his dad, who was very sick, so he was desperate for something more flexible than a regular job.
And then I always wanted to do, you know, something on my own, start my own business.
Around that time, JanPro was running these ads.
Your own business could be just over the horizon.
They sold Jerry his own cleaning franchise. Jerry gave them a $5,000 down payment, money he had to borrow from his mom. JanPro said they'd find him enough cleaning customers to bring him a certain amount in gross income each year. JanPro would negotiate the prices with his customers, collect payments from them, and then, once a month, JanPro would pay Jerry what the cleaning customers had paid them, minus a bunch of franchise fees and financing payments. Once Jerry realized how little money he was actually earning from the cleaning, he decided he needed to charge his customers a higher rate. But he says JanPro discouraged him from doing that, or talking to customers at all. Jerry tried to make things work for about a year, but it was a struggle.
You're basically just barely making it. You clip coupons and, you know, it's like, hey, we get to eat today, so let's thank God.
But the more Jerry thought about his situation, about how he went to a JanPro office to pick up a check each month, how they could fine him for not wearing their uniform, how they monitored his work, set the prices of his accounts, how his labor seemed to be essential to JanPro's cleaning business, Jerry decided on paper he was a business owner, but really?
Felt like I wasn't a franchise owner. I felt like I was an employee.
Turns out this feeling has a technical legal name, misclassification. That's what it's called when a company labels a worker an independent contractor, when really they should be considered an employee with all the rights that come with employment. Because sure, if Jerry was really an independent contractor running his own business, how much he makes is his problem. But if Jerry is an employee, JanPro owes him a minimum wage and overtime. David Weil is a professor at Brandeis University. During the Obama administration, he ran the agency that enforces wage laws. He says misclassification is a tactic that all kinds of companies have used to avoid the costs and responsibilities that come with being an employer.
But at the same time, these companies are still controlling everything that actually affects the life of those workers.
Misclassification is especially common in low-wage industries like construction, home care, driving and delivery services, and janitorial services.
Where there are many immigrant workers, or there are workers so dependent on their paycheck that they basically keep their head down.
Jerry did not keep his head down. He filed a lawsuit against JanPro on behalf of himself and other JanPro cleaning franchisees. JanPro declined to comment for this story, but in court, they've argued that franchisers have to have some control over their franchisees to maintain the integrity of their brand, and that shouldn't make them an employer. Jerry's case still isn't settled after more than 10 years. This question of where to draw the line between employee and independent contractor is something courts have struggled with for decades. Meanwhile, Jerry says getting paid less than minimum wage has hurt him and his family. But it's more than that.
If you're making less money now, that means I'm spending less money in the economy. So even all the other businesses around get hurt.
Jerry says if he does someday win his case, he'll finally be able to pay his mom back for the money she lent him to buy the franchise in the first place. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
There is more of Jerry's story and A bit of the history of what happened to the American job on the Uncertain Hour podcast. Subscribe, would you, on your platform of choice. Coming up.
The ability to look at ourselves and to laugh at ourselves and to move forward.
Sometimes laughter is, yes, the best medicine. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 64 points today, 0.2%, 31,522. The NASDAQ down 47 points, about 0.3%, 14,047. The S&P 500 basically flat, 39 and 32. Of course, the big story today is power. So, some publicly traded power companies. Vistra is a Texas-based company. One of its subsidiaries is the Texas power company TXU Energy. Sparked up 2.7% today. With power outages in mind, we look at companies that make generators. More consumers may be thinking about that right now. Caterpillar revved up 2.2%. John Deere heated up 1.3%. Also handy if you're in the market for big farm and construction equipment, right? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've been talking a bit about Texas on the program today. Not really the place that comes to mind when you think of deadly snow and cold, but often it is the place that comes to mind when you think about oil and the energy economy. Not all that long ago, though, North Dakota was the heart of the American oil boom, with people, men, really, flooding towns like Williston, North Dakota, looking for work. Michael Patrick F. Smith was one of those people. His new book is called The Good Hand, a memoir of work brotherhood and transformation in an American boomtown. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Good to have you on. Tell me why you went up to North Dakota in 2013. What were you looking for?
Sure thing. There's a lot of things I was looking for, in a lot of different ways. But, one thing I was looking for was a way to make a lot of money as fast as I could. And besides that, there were, personal demons, I guess you could say, were chasing me. I felt sort of dissatisfied with my life, and I was looking for a way to, find more meaning somewhere.
When you got there, what was it like?
It was a wild place, man. So Williston was 10 to 12,000 people in it only about 5 years before I got there. And the population when I arrived had all but tripled, and some people say quintupled. So you had guys sleeping in their trucks outside the job services office, everybody kind of looking for work and also looking for a place to live. Rent was incredibly, incredibly high out there. While I was there, it became more expensive than San Francisco.
Wow. With all those men up there, and as you say, they are almost all men, or were almost all men, it was tough for you to find a job, which kind of floored me.
Well, I actually found a job pretty quickly. It took me about a month, but it was a long month. It was knocking on a lot of doors and talking to a lot of different people. And I kind of just happened to show up on the right day at a trucking company that was looking for people to help move oil rigs.
Tell me about that. You were, I guess the job is you were a swamper? I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so oil rigs are kind of, they're like big Lego pieces about the size of skyscrapers, and they sit in one place for about 2.5 months. And then once the oil gets flowing, they need to be taken apart and put onto haul trucks, moved to another location, and put back together. A swamper is a rigger, and so I worked with cranes, and I worked on the back of what's called a gin truck, basically throwing chains and hooks on giant pieces of steel, trying to keep them level and not flip a truck or get anybody hurt so that we could move everything down the road and then reassemble it.
Did you know what you were doing? I mean, you could have killed somebody.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing, man. I mean, it's a trial by fire experience. But eventually, I did get pretty handy with it and, you know, managed to do it to the best of my ability. The book is very much about me trying to get it together.
Yeah, well, so let's talk about the subtitle of this book a little bit. It's a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation, you write. The work part we got, we just talked about that. Tell me about the brotherhood, because you became, I gather by reading this book, almost despite yourself, close with some of these guys.
Yeah, sure thing, man. I'm not really, I'm not a traditional journalist. I went out there to get the job and the people that I worked with, though I had oftentimes great differences with. We were working together to do an incredibly difficult thing, and I really fell in love with the guys I was working with.
The other part of the subtitle of this book is transformation, and I guess I wonder what transformation you're talking about, because I got one in mind.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I guess I would highlight the personal transformation. And I had studied theater. I was an actor and I loved playing music. I kind of came from an artistic background, but also I'd grown up on a farm in central Maryland and had a pretty rough customer for a dad. So the transformation, one of them anyway, is certainly just my own attempt to sort of pull all those strings of my life together into one whole person.
Which comes through in the book for sure. I wonder, though, if a little bit of what you're writing about here is the transformation of work in this economy, the transformation of how we think about our jobs, oil and energy. You wrote a piece in the New York Times the other day about that. I mean, there's a lot in the subtext of this book.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that the transformation of the economy is absolutely a huge part of it. And I was frankly so surprised to meet the guys that I met who were, you know, these were guys who had been working in the silver mines, who then moved to Williston to do work in the oil field. And then the oil field went bust. And some of them moved down to Texas to work in the Permian. It's a brutal, tough lifestyle. I think, too, that there's the issue of kind of you know, this transformation to a service economy or an economy with full of jobs that maybe don't give people meaning. I've worked a lot of different gigs, you know, and it's hard to find something that really makes me feel like I'm contributing to society.
It's a book called The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Michael Patrick F. Smith wrote it. Michael, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I do appreciate it.
One year, almost, into this pandemic, we've gotten to the point where a good chunk of what we're seeing on TV has been made in virus times. And that poses some challenges. Nanochka Khan, who created Fresh Off the Boat 5 or 6 years ago, has a new comedy premiering tonight, Young Rock, it's called, the life story of one Dwayne The Rock Johnson. They filmed last fall when things actually in Hollywood we're still kind of a little iffy virus-wise. So the whole cast and crew took off for Australia, which when I talked to Nanochka Khan the other day, I pointed out must have been a big deal.
It was pretty big. I mean, I personally have never been to Australia, let alone shot anything in Australia. So we had the 2 weeks of quarantine, which was very intense. But I'm so grateful that we were able to go down there and make this show.
Following on to that, you know, you've got many other irons in the fire. And we're not out of this pandemic yet. What's your production model? I mean, how big a deal is this for you just for everything else you're trying to do?
I mean, it's very challenging. I think that everybody's figuring it out. And of course, it affects the bottom line because you have all these safety protocols in place and costs that you never had before. But of course, it's worth it to keep everybody safe and you know, to keep it the machine running.
Do you think it's ever going to go back to normal? Yeah,
I don't know. I honestly, I don't know if it's ever going to go back to the way it was, where people were just freely kind of moving around and coming in and out. You know, I think it's always going to be a little bit different.
I'm just letting that hang there because I kind of can't wrap my head around it. But I guess the but I guess the interview has to go on. well, you know, I want to talk to you about you for a second, because you're the writer director, you're the creator, you're the person who can do it, but also run the show. It's like Mike Schur and Shonda Rhimes, right? Which is pretty elevated company. Why do you think you all are what Hollywood is looking for right now?
Well, I'm flattered to be put in the company of those two. There's a whole process that goes into greenlighting different projects. And of course, you know, the fact that they believe in the stories I want to tell and they support that, you know, I find myself just in a very lucky position.
What do you make, though, of this move, of this moment in this society and I guess in your business as well, right? We're trying to center people of color. We're trying to center underrepresented groups. You are telling those stories with Dwayne. You told it with Fresh Off the Boat. It seems like there's a moment here for you.
Well, I mean, I think that the more opportunities that we have to center those people, the sections of society that you mentioned that have not been centered before, the better we all are for it, you know, because there are so many stories. Just because we haven't seen these stories on television or in movies doesn't mean that they haven't happened, right? It doesn't mean that they don't exist. So the idea that we now have opportunities and platforms, think of all the stories out there that we don't know about yet. And that those are the things that get me excited.
Why comedy for you?
I mean, to me, it's just always what I've gravitated towards. I think that any message that you want to deliver, I personally am able to do it when it's wrapped up in something that's amusing and interesting. That's just the way my mind works.
So here's the tricky last question to a comedy person. Do you think we're ever going to be able to laugh about the past year that we've had? Are there comedies coming out of this pandemic, do you think?
Definitely. Definitely. Wow. I don't think we'll be able to laugh at, of course, the tragedy.
Yeah.
But I think we'll be able to laugh at the way that we adapted to our lives being turned upside down, you know, and the ability to look at ourselves and to laugh at ourselves and to move forward, you know, being able to laugh, even if it's through tears. Mm. And again, not to diminish the toll that it's taken, but I do think that comedy is never going to go away.
The latest from the Nanochka Khan is on NBC. It's called Young Rock. Nanochka, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
This final note on the way out today. We don't usually do a whole lot of obituaries on this program, but there is a passing that I want to note today. Arne Sorensen has died. Mr. Sorensen was the CEO of Marriott. He was a guest on this program a couple of times, most recently last March, just as all of this was getting going. Difficult for a guy running a travel company, especially difficult for Arne Sorensen in that moment, as you'll hear in this clip from a little bit more than a year ago. Last thing, Mr. Sorensen, and then I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to take a turn to the personal here, and I'm just going to see how it goes. So you put out a video on Twitter a week ago today, which somehow seems like a really long time ago, to all Marriott employees. And we should say here you are being treated for pancreatic cancer. You look like you are being treated for pancreatic cancer. And you said in the beginning of this video that your advisors had suggested you not do video maybe. Because of that. And you went on and you delivered a really sober but fundamentally uplifting message. But I want to get to the end of it. The thing ran like 5 minutes. And it was clear to me at the end that you got emotional. And I guess the question coming out of that is, are you scared?
I am, how to answer that question? I'm terrified of the impact to the thousands of people that we've got across the world who depend on the work that they do for us, for their livelihoods and for their families' livelihoods. And I'm terrified that they have the resources that they need in order to get through it. We're still early in this process. While furloughs have happened across the world and people are getting used to that, we're in the first week or two in the United States where that's the case. Now, we're a few months in advance of that across Asia Pacific, but the impact to people's lives will be profound. And we took three takes on that video, and I'll confess that I didn't choke up in exactly the same sentence every time, but I did choke up every one of the three times, and I wasn't intending to. And I said to the crew afterwards, figure out what you can use from that. But I choke up because I just think of the profound impact to the lives of folks who have zero responsibility for the crisis that we're in and who will pay a price which is much higher than they deserve to pay. They don't deserve to pay any price. And so we've got to find a way, communicating with them, being transparent with them, to get through this together. We will ultimately. People will come back to life because we're a resilient people all across the globe, including particularly in the United States. But we got to get there sooner rather than later in order to minimize the pain that so many will bear.
Arne Sorensen, last year on this program, the CEO of Marriott died yesterday. All right, we got to go. Carrie Barber, Ben Hethcote, and Janet Wynn do digital and on-demand for us. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.